This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On December 8th in El Paso, Texas, Guatemalan national Jacqueline Calmaquin died in the custody of U.S. Border Patrol. She had entered the United States 2 days earlier with 162 other migrants. She'd had fever near 106 degrees and persistent vomiting, and family members said she was given no water by authorities when she was first held at a remote New Mexico station. Her death came after many hours of waiting and bus travel, followed by a helicopter evacuation to a Texas emergency room. Jacqueline was 7 years old. The particulars of her illness and death are still not clear. Her father, with whom she was apprehended, has asked the press not to speculate. Also ambiguous is the level of attention paid by authorities. Although clearly the Border Patrol's Bounds Forward operating base, where the calls were first taken, is not equipped for medical emergencies. What is clear is this. Despite explicit rules, Congress was not notified of her death for 5 days after the Washington Post had already reported it. And secondly, according to the Trump administration, Jacqueline's death is her parents' fault.
This family chose to cross illegally. What happened here was they were about 90 miles away from where we could process them. They came in such a large crowd that it took our Border Patrol folks a couple times to get them all. We gave immediate care. We'll continue to look into the situation. But again, I cannot stress how dangerous this journey is when migrants choose to come here illegally.
That was Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen. That talking point did not sit well.
Jacqueline Calmaquin, the new face of what some are calling a humanitarian crisis.
Outrage at the border tonight over the death of a 7-year-old girl.
I place the blame where it belongs. The tone and tenor of all of this starts at the top. The President of the United States of America.
Yes, a spasm of outrage, just as there was a spasm of outrage over the forced separation of children from their parents at the border, just as there were spasms of outrage at conditions in the archipelago of detention facilities, and at the president's rhetoric, and at the naked racism of cable TV hosts. But like most everything else in the ongoing cruelty of zero tolerance, it quickly evaporated, replaced by a succession of other grotesqueries. Literally, as we record this, the president is threatening to shut down the U.S. government unless he gets $5 billion for a border wall, and so on. Aura Bogado is an immigration reporter for Reveal, the news site and podcast from the Center for Investigative Reporting. She's been covering immigration for a decade and doesn't have the luxury of intermittent attention to an ongoing nightmare. Aura, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
When Jacqueline died, I said to myself, surely this will capture and hold the attention of the press and public. Surely Americans will go out on the streets and demand an end to cruelty in our name. You didn't think any of those things, did you?
When I saw this, I was completely horrified, as I think everybody else was. But I did think, I wonder how long this will pass, particularly given that holidays are coming and people will have something else to pay attention to.
I don't want to discuss politics or policy here. I want to ask you, when asylum seekers or other migrants surrender or are caught, what are the conditions they experience?
No matter if you turn yourself in at a port of entry or you're apprehended for crossing without authorization, you will be placed into what is called a hielera, an icebox. A freezing cell, it's always concrete. Sometimes you just hardly have places to walk in between all of the people that are either sitting down, standing up, or laying down.
Concrete floors, hard benches, no beds, and for some reason, cold. Why cold?
The CBP may tell you that that's in order to control infectious diseases. Contagion is less likely to spread when it's colder instead of hotter. By the way, contagion is less likely to spread when you don't crowd people in inhumane conditions. I often get to see the medical records of both adults and children who have spent time in hieleras. Very often, there's swollen lymph nodes, which indicates infection. They may be sick before they get there. They may be sick once they're already there for a few days. But it's very common that kids are sick.
The children are often placed in other jails called Las Pereras.
Perera are probably the images that people are most used to. Those have the chain link fence. They're sort of a small mattress. They tend to be a little less crowded. However, they sometimes are very, very overcrowded.
And La Perera, it means dog kennel.
These are the words that people use to describe what happens when they cross. Iceboxes and dog kennels. People don't ask if I'm familiar with the word. They're just like, oh, and I was in the hielera, and then they put me in the perera, and it goes back and forth.
Aura, tell me about the smells of captivity.
Over and over again, for the hieleras in particular, people will tell you that they know how long other people have been there because of the way that they smell. You can't bathe. And so what people try to do is they use the little sink water that's attached to the toilet that they just used, and so did everyone else use. Women have told me about this over and over again. They smell so bad, they develop sores consistent with not having been able to be bathed. Sometimes you do get like a little hand towel. People tell me that they're very grateful when that comes. You're supposed to get that right when you come in. That's not always the case. When you do decide to wipe yourself down, that's another thing. It's, I had to wash myself somehow, but it was so cold. The other thing is you get zero privacy. There is no door, period. If you're lucky, you get a little plastic sheet that opens back and forth. A lot of times people describe not wanting to touch it because it's got poop on it.
Tell me about drugging children.
Earlier this summer, we broke the story of a place called the Shiloh Treatment Center, just outside of Houston, Texas. What happens is children who arrive unaccompanied and then for some reason were identified to have certain psychiatric issues that the shelter couldn't handle, they are then sent to a place called a residential treatment center. In this case, it's called Shiloh. For Shiloh, a source had told me about court records that alleged forced drugging with pills and injections without the consent of the child or the parent. For me, it became important to really track down children who were there. I didn't want just the court record with anonymous names. I did talk to several children who were there. There was one family in New Orleans who did allow me to spend time with them and to talk to them about what happened to their 10-year-old. You know, he wound up there because he repeatedly said that he wanted to run away. And then he did try to run away once. He knew that he was in the United States, and he knew that he wanted to be reunited with his mom. That was enough for a psychiatric evaluation, which found that he needed more professional help than what the shelter could provide. He was then sent to Shiloh and forcibly drugged for 4 months. His mom, over time, she was able to do video calls with him, and she found him to be just absolutely lethargic.
What you're describing could be the consequence of medical authorities paying close attention to the psychiatric well-being of those in custody, or some sort of Soviet warehousing of prisoners under a flimsy pretext of psychiatric issues. Do you have a sense of which of these things is taking place?
In my non-medical professional opinion, I think he really wanted to be with his mom. If he had to run away in order to be with her, that's what he was going to do. I can tell you that as I kept digging, I found that the psychiatrist who writes all of these prescriptions and evaluates all the children, his name is Dr. Ruiz. The government had testified that he was board certified to treat adolescents and children, I looked into the record and I found that although he is fully licensed, he actually lost that board certification about 10 years ago.
You had another story this summer about kids being held in a vacant office building in Phoenix.
We got a tip that someone said that, you know, they're putting all these kids in this vacant office, and here's a video. The first time I saw the video, I was like, is this a setup? This just looks too unreal. I watched it about two or three times, and I want to say I was on a flight at like 5 a.m. the next day to Phoenix. The children were no longer there, but this neighbor and I, you know, we walked right up to the door and we saw a medication schedule for one of the children. We saw a box that was labeled baby shampoo, which was consistent with one of the toddlers that we saw being filed into this vacant office in the video. We moved really quickly to figure out that a private defense contractor called MVM Incorporated, they've operated in like Iraq and Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay. They are now charged with transporting children. They were holding children in this office overnight. They wouldn't admit to doing so, but children had at least spent at least two nights there, if not more. We don't know the full number of kids that did so because the company won't tell us. ICE won't tell us. This little boy who I was able to track down, you know, he came with his mom. He spent time in the Yelera with her. And then he was taken away by a defense contractor. And then he was held in this like vacant office. He says that people were nice to him there. He got three sandwiches a day. He didn't think it was a bad thing. He knows violence in a different way, right? To him, violence isn't necessarily having to sleep on a floor with a whole bunch of teenagers in an unauthorized vacant office that nobody knows about. Violence is knowing that some of his friends have been killed by gang members in this totally rural area of Guatemala. I think that sometimes things are relative to people, right? People are leaving situations for certain reasons.
As an institution, what is the press just getting wrong here? And do we have any responsibility for the public's fluctuating levels of outrage?
I can tell you that we absolutely have a responsibility in the Trump era, especially to include the perspectives of people who are most affected by the policies that we write about. We can only do that when we start to consider that the people who are dying from some of these policies are high-level sources. If I have a source who's high up in the government, you bet. Like, I am texting them for random things that have nothing to do with immigration, check in how they're doing, might grab a coffee if we're in the same town. You know, we sort of are always in touch. Most of the reporters on my beat have no such sources in the immigrant community. I've heard a lot of times reporters ask a random person at a bus stop that was just released from detention, like, why did you come to the United States? That's a fair question, but I think it betrays the originating reason of why did you leave your country? Being deeply immersed, not just in the national security sources, but being well immersed in the communities that we write about. That's what's missing.
So finally, I want to come back to something that did not happen at our southern border, but happened in Turkey when a three-year-old Syrian boy, Alan Kurdi, washed up on the beach. He was dead. He was part of an attempted migration into Europe, fleeing the Holocaust in Syria. That did horrify the world. And I wonder if there were a picture of 7-year-old Jacqueline's dead body, would that spur us out of our complacency?
A different question to ask is, why would it take that? Knowing everything that we know, if we listen to people who have sustained these conditions for more than a decade, and that doesn't bring us to reconsider what's really happening in the way that we think about people's movement, particularly when fleeing violence, sometimes as a result of long-term intervention by the United States. The rescue group, the NGO that scours the desert for missing loved ones, you know, one of the bodies that they found The volunteers estimate that it was a little child, about 6 years old. And that's just, it's just talking with the man who sort of leads this group. He just paused, not unlike you just did, and was like, the bones are so small. They're just so small. So that is who's already dying on the border. I don't know that seeing the remains will necessarily change anything. I think that listening in a more sustained way and challenging ourselves to do so might.
Aura, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Aura Mogado is an immigration reporter for Reveal, the news site and podcast from the Center for Investigative Reporting.
Coming up, guess what? Sometimes journalism does have an impact.
This is On the Media.
Hi, I'm Helga Davis. On my show, I speak with artists and thinkers about how to uncover the extraordinary in everyday life. People like musicians Brittany Howard and Sampha, Broadway director Whitney White, scholar Noli Way Rooks, and playwright Suzanne Laurie Parks. These are fearless conversations where we don't just meet each other, we meet ourselves. Join us. Listen to Helga wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It may seem that for 2 years, the entire Washington Press Corps has been devoted 24-7 to the Mueller investigation and the daily stream of Trump-ruptions from the White House. Most recently, the decision to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria and the immediate resignation of Defense Secretary James Mattis. But the press does cover other things, including, as a matter of fact, that extremely fast-moving presidential cabinet departure beat. Not to be distracted by nuclear brinksmanship or border walls, some hardworking D.C. reporters have attended to the actual business of governance, including the funny business of governance. Former Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price was hounded out of town for ethical transgressions. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt was hounded out of town for ethical transgressions. And this week, the exposed transgressor was Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke. All departures courtesy of journalism. In a recent newsletter of the Columbia Journalism Review, reporter John Alsop documented how the press got the goods. John, welcome to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
The first to go back in September of 2017 was Tom Price, who resigned to spend more time with his lawyers.
Yeah, Politico got the story that Tom Price was using, I think, private and even military planes, all on the taxpayer dime.
For a secretary to rack up more than $1 million in travel spending over just 4 months, and for that secretary to be someone who has criticized the federal government for waste, it's just created a maelstrom.
And they went to extraordinary lengths, the reporters from Politico, to reconstruct Price's flying habits in the absence of him providing an official schedule for that. So I think they ended up going and actually staking out airports to see him on the tarmac. It was all pretty inventive stuff. They got the story, and pretty soon afterwards, Price stepped aside.
When you come roaring into town like Oliver Cromwell looking for witches to burn and condemning the establishment, you have to expect some blowback. Tom Price was supposed to repeal Obamacare. Instead, he got repealed.
I think in this administration, the interest has been heightened because Trump, you know, came in on this promise to drain the swamp.
The swamp of Washington. We're going to have fun doing it. We're all doing it together.
You know, every time he said that, journalists on those kind of beats covering federal departments, agencies, saw it as a challenge.
Then came the second to go, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt in July of this year. It's almost comical, the number of ethics investigations that are still going on about this guy and how petty were the favors and gratuities he apparently accepted. Can you give me the quick rundown?
Well, if I gave you the quick rundown, I think we'd be here into 2019. But some of the more inventive, shall we say, uses of government time and money that Scott Pruitt allegedly engaged in were...
Pruitt got a sweetheart deal to live in this Capitol Hill condo with his adult daughter for the low, low price of $50 a night. And, crucially, he only had to pay that when he actually slept there. So, who would give him such a ridiculous deal? Well, the condo just happens to be co-owned by the wife of a top energy lobbyist, someone very interested in the goings-on at Pruitt's EPA.
At one point, he asked aides to get him a used mattress from a Trump hotel.
Pruitt allegedly used his capacity as a cabinet-level official of the U.S. government to get his wife a Chick-fil-A fast food franchise.
Those were just kind of ones that I think were particularly attention-grabbing.
Okay, and then finally this month, the hat trick came with Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke, who will be leaving the administration after the first of the year. What did he do?
It was kind of an interesting resignation, I think, compared to the resignations of Price and Pruitt, because Price's resignation came pretty soon after Politico detailed his irregular traveling behavior. Pruitt, it was because, as you said, it kind of chalked up this long list of scandals that just kept going and going. Zinke has been comparatively out of the headlines for a while, but there have been a number of investigations opened into his conduct, at least half a dozen opened by the Inspector General inside of the Interior Department. Particularly, there was a report in Politico which set a lot of this in motion earlier this year, which was to do with a real estate deal
that involved a foundation set up by Mr. Zinke and a development group backed by the chairman of Halliburton. They're a company that does a whole lot of business with the U.S. government.
It seemed like, you know, a pretty clear example of a conflict of interest. Now, it's not like he stepped aside immediately after that report came out, but what it did was it set in chain a complaint made by Democratic lawmakers, an investigation opened within his department. I believe part of that at least has been transferred over to the Justice Department now. There are reports that the White House was getting fed up with this ratcheting up of various different scandals and ethical probes. And according to Bloomberg and others who reported on this story, Zinke also kind of decided to get out of town before the Democrats took charge of the House in January because they were really trying to hold his feet to the fire over some of this stuff.
There's an argument that says, and I've seen a couple of pieces to this effect, that these guys were so ham-fisted and stupid that it was fairly easy for journalists to catch them in the act, but that their replacements are more traditional creatures of Washington, much more polished at what they do, and therefore far more capable of doing the work begun by Pruitt and Zinke without attracting attention, and that is dismantling the regulatory protections, mainly on the environment. So the press did its job, but does this necessarily mean that the public wins?
Well, I was quite heartened to find out about David Bernhardt, the probable interim replacement for Zinke, to see that lots of news organizations already had stories up saying who he was.
An energy lobbyist.
Yeah, but clearly it's harder, particularly in our congested present news cycle, to get people to pay attention to the nitty-gritty of policy without maybe having that hook of trying to get your wife a job at Chick-fil-A or doing a kind of dodgy real estate deal or taking a private flight. I think those stories were useful to get the public to pay attention to the agenda of those figures. Now, with less colorful figures in charge, that agenda's still going on, and I think it can be harder to get the public to pay attention to that. But I don't think it's for want of trying, necessarily.
John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
John Alsop is a freelance journalist. He writes CGR's newsletter, The Media Today.
The investigations into the Trump administration this year prove that growing mistrust of and antagonism toward the press will not hamper the work here. Worldwide, Reporters Without Borders has tracked 80 journalists killed this year, 348 behind bars, countless stories untold.
I was working at my desk when I heard the shots, and I looked at Anthony, the intern, and I said, I'm getting out of here, and I grabbed my purse and I went to the back door. It was locked. What happened here was very calculated.
Journalist Celine Sanfelice survived the Capital Gazette massacre in Annapolis last summer. The gunman, enraged by the paper's past coverage of his crimes, retaliated by taking the lives of five men and women.
Wendy Winters, who worked on special publications, Gerald Fishman, editor of the editorial page, John McNamara, a staff writer who covered sports, Rebecca Smith, a sales assistant, and Robert Heisen, the paper's assistant editor.
The shooting gave Americans a taste of what journalists increasingly navigate abroad. In Mexico, 9 were murdered for tracking drug cartels and local corruption. In Syria, 11. Afghanistan, 15. A 24-year-old Palestinian, Ahmad Abu Hussein, was shot in the gut while covering demonstrations in Gaza this spring.
A video of the incident when he was shot April 13th that shows he was standing in a crowd far away from a fence when it appears that he was specifically targeted.
It's impossible to predict when or if the risks journalists take to bear witness will have an impact. The tragic truth is that sometimes it's their deaths that change things.
Slovakia, where the government is on the brink of collapse amid a crisis triggered by the killing of a young journalist.
This is Jan Kuciak and his girlfriend Martina Kushnirova. Now, they were both found with single gunshot wounds to their heads.
Kuciak was investigating tax fraud by people associated with Slovakia's ruling party.
The murders sparked the biggest protest in the region since the Velvet Revolution of 1989, forcing the resignation of Slovakia's Prime Minister Robert Fico and his cabinet. And of course, the grisly murder of reporter Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul has shone a harsh light on the wrongs he sought to right. Calling on the Saudi crown prince to end the blood-drenched war in Yemen, neither the crown prince nor the U.S. president took heed, but the Congress did.
The U.S. Senate has passed a resolution symbolically ending all U.S. military support for Saudi and Emirati forces fighting in the Yemeni civil war.
Powerful people can do terrible things in the dark, but committed journalists force us to confront what really matters. We don't spend a lot of time on this show on journalists in peril. We know that they know when they're taking a risk, but we owe them. So we're taking this moment to honor their sacrifice. This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Back in 95, when NPR made me its first media reporter, a colleague emailed, "Media reporter, I hope you do a story on papier-mâché. It's my favorite medium." Of course, since the primordial days of cave painting, art in countless forms has been a prime medium of human expression. But how does the creative spark catch fire? This is a story of one unlikely blaze. In 1887, Hilma af Klint was one of the first women to graduate Stockholm's Royal Academy of Fine Arts, and she went on to paint exquisite landscapes and portraits in the style of the day. She was small, with blue eyes and mostly black clothes, unmarried and unconnected to the modern movements brewing elsewhere. Back then, no one would have guessed she'd cover the walls of one of the world's most famous repositories of modern and especially abstract art. For one thing, the spiral temple in Manhattan known as the Guggenheim Museum hadn't yet been built.
What we see mostly here in the exhibition are the works that she did under her spiritualist practice.
Tracy Bashkov curated the Guggenheim show, Hilma af Klint, Paintings for the Future.
Working as a medium, she took on a commission that was given to her by the higher spirits that she was communing with to paint works that would eventually fill a temple. And that's where she really pushed the boundaries.
Funny word, medium. It can mean anything from papier-mâché to serving as the earthly tool of a disembodied spirit. During a seance in 1904, Hilma af Klint heard a voice directing her to render and paint a new philosophy of life. She painted shapes, coiled and swirling, stable and sublime, derived from both nature and pure geometry. It was a staggering departure from the work that had defined her career and far ahead of her time. As Roberta Smith observed in a piece on the show for the New York Times, in the year 1907, when these massive, immersive paintings were made, Picasso had just cracked open the door to cubism, while the ostensible pioneers of modernist abstraction, Casimir Malevich, Piet Mondrian, and Vasily Kandinsky, were years away from their breakthroughs.
What she's doing here that's so different from what was going on at this time is that she's combining sort of naturalist forms and abstract forms in these compositions that are wholly abstract. And so she's really freed herself up from the description of the world outside our windows in a big way. It's amazing. I mean, you'll see tons of things in the exhibition that remind you of artists who were working way later than she was.
At the time of their creation, Afklint was quietly devising modes of abstraction guided by spiritualism, a faith she'd long ago embraced, based on the belief that every individual was capable of touching the sublime without intervention by priestly intermediaries. Spiritualism was ideally suited to women who preferred to rule themselves.
And so while working as a medium is a way of kind of putting aside your personality and allowing another voice to speak through you, it was also a way that women had sort of direct access to these ideas of the divine and to ideas of authority. And it gave them a voice, whether one believes in the practice or not, to speak in it in some form.
As a working artist, Afklint practiced spiritualism with four other women artists. They called themselves the Five.
They met weekly and had these seances that were structured kind of like a religious service. They read from the Old Testament, there was a sermon, and then there was a moment where they attempted to contact other higher spirits.
Spirits named Emiliel, Ananda, Clemens, Esther, Georg, and Gregor, who led the Five into other worlds and ways of seeing. Afklint was with them when she heard what she called the spirit's divine dictation. She was 42 years old.
Starting in 1904, a spirit first approached her about the idea that there would one day be a temple that needed to be filled with paintings. But later in her life, she turns her thoughts to what this temple might look like.
And what was it?
So it was a round building that people would progress through in a spiral path as they encounter all of the works of the paintings for the temple, and it would lead upward to an altarpiece at the center where the 10 largest paintings would exist.
Spiral to a final altarpiece. She thought about this, drew sketches of this in the 30s. Let it be submitted that the Guggenheim was opened in 1959.
That's right. Right.
I recently walked through the exhibition of nearly 200 works with Bashkov, starting in a gallery featuring the 10 large luminous canvases she mentioned, over 3 meters tall, marking the stages of life from childhood through youth, adulthood, and old age. Each, frankly, gorgeous, each with its own motion and messages, almost like a set of maps to different precincts of the spiritual cosmos. As many have said, this is trippy stuff.
Floral forms and biomorphic forms. We see kind of shell and seed shape. The second to last painting here has this, it looks like a two-lobed, almost a heart shape, but it's also perhaps a seed, the beginning of life or what grows after life is over and then feeds into a new life thereafter.
The last one stands apart from all the others because it uses straight lines. It squares within squares, a central pattern.
Right. We see a tendency in her work to almost diagram things and to try to come to terms with these spiritual ideas and this voyage and this message that she was passing on with these paintings and trying to put them in a scientific language.
As we spiraled our way to the top of the museum, we passed canvases suffused with rich and strange colors, denoting masculine and feminine, the gush of life and the serenity of cosmic order, spirals and snails, petals and mysterious letters, series with names like Primordial Chaos and Seven-Pointed Star, culminating in 3 large works, the altarpieces, bright, bold canvases with triangles and rainbows and spirals and shades of the dark side of the moon.
They give the opportunity of expanding the mind, of looking into it and seeing more than what I usually just think and feel about.
A visitor from Santa Barbara, in town to sing with his choir at Carnegie Hall, seemed to imbibe the enigmatic work like a tonic.
This particular picture with the rainbows and then the center shows a huge expanse of infinite space and creative possibility and brightness and a livingness and a great positive view of life. And we can draw upon all the other elements around it, it looks like to me, from the most gross concrete to the brightest colorful, but there's a brightness about it that's encouraging.
We seem to be the audience that perhaps she was looking for.
Apparently. This is Off Clint's first major show, and it's been a smashing success. But she was convinced no such audience existed when she made these works.
Slightly before she dies, she records that she wants the work to not be seen for 20 years after her death, that she feels the world isn't ready for the messages that her paintings contain, and that they should be held for future audiences.
We don't know why she thought that. It may have been the spirits. It may have been the renowned erstwhile theosophist Rudolf Steiner. Long story. It may have just been her. She died in 1944, struck down by that emblem of modernity, the streetcar, at the age of 82, an artist to the end with less than $100 in the bank. Despite a few determined attempts, her work went virtually unseen for far more than 20 years. But it finally happened when Maurice Tuckman included her work as part of a group exhibit on spirituality and abstract art at LACMA, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, in 1986. The Guggenheim's Tracy Bashkoff, a Kandinsky specialist, was intrigued by the exhibit catalog and saw a direct line between Off Clint's work and the Guggenheim's history of exploring the spiritual and utopian aspects of abstraction. But it was only in 2013, years after Bashkoff had started planning the exhibition, that she even learned of Off Clint's temple plans.
So I went to Stockholm for this two-day conference, and it was there that I first heard that she had these plans for a spiral-shaped temple. And so it was, you know, as if the story wrote itself from that point. You know, we know that the founder of this museum, the woman that worked with Solomon Guggenheim, a woman named Hilla von Riebe, who was an artist herself, was also a theosophist and attended Steiner lectures. And when she wrote to Frank Lloyd Wright to ask him if he would consider building a museum to house Solomon R. Guggenheim's collection, she said that she wanted a temple of spirit. And so this is where we ended up.
This convergence across time suggests, as it often does, that ideas may emerge again and again spontaneously and are not always and merely passed from one person to the next.
So yeah. The whole idea of who was the first abstract artist is one that we need to question, not only because we've ascribed it to, you know, this handful of men for many years and that, you know, ignored sort of the presence of Hilma af Klint, but that it is a faulty game to begin with, that it goes back much further to symbols and stones and cave paintings. And so it doesn't make what Hilma af Klint was doing any less earth-shattering. And
part of a continuum. But, and so the fact that she was earlier than a lot of people that we may have regarded as pioneers, in the long run, doesn't even matter because there's so many antecedents to her.
No, I think what matters is that her presence puts all these pressures on the right points. It lets us think more expansively about who should be included in that story, whether it's about gender, whether it's about geography or philosophical thought, but that we just have a wider playing field than we've ever imagined.
Tracy Bashkoff is director of collections and senior curator at the Guggenheim. Hilma af Klint, Paintings for the Future, is on display through April 23rd, 2019. Frank Lloyd Wright once said that every building is a missionary. I don't build a house without predicting the end of the present social order. And so it was ultimately with Hilma af Klint. Her art was as subversive as her faith, a revolutionary religion for a revolutionary time. And it sprouted in the U.S., according to historian Anne Browdy, in the year 1848, the year of the February Revolution in France and the March Revolution in the German states, and upheaval in about 50 other countries where people demanded a free press, self-rule, and workers' rights. And here, an end to slavery and rights for women in the nation's first women's rights convention in Seneca Falls, New York.
Right in the same neighborhood and involving some of the same individuals, the emergence of spirit communication through the Fox sisters, three adolescent sisters, they heard these raps on the floor and furniture of their cottage, and they attributed them to the spirits of a dead peddler who they believed might be buried in the cottage. Now, this could be any adolescent prank, but the adults who surrounded them took this seriously, and among those adults were Isaac and Amy Post, distinguished Quaker abolitionists.
The Quaker notion was that every individual is a perfect transcript of the mind of God, and it is the inner light within each of us that gives us access to the truth.
Amen. Sounds like you're quoting from my book.
I am. So these two well-respected Quaker abolitionist reformers bring the Fox sisters to their home near Rochester, New York, and they form a kind of proto Ouija board in order to communicate more directly with the spirit world.
That's exactly right. Isaac Post writes out the alphabet on a piece of paper, and he moves his hand over the piece of paper, and he stops when the spirit raps manifest themselves. And they soon are able to receive communications from dead relatives that they can identify. The Fox sisters were understood as passive vehicles that were being used by spirits, external intelligences, who spoke through these girls.
And what did they say? These weren't Socrates and Shakespeare.
They were Socrates and Shakespeare. Eventually, as mediumship became more developed, more and more famous people communicated. But the initial communications were with dead relatives. That is the hunger that made people sit around the seance table, the hunger to reestablish communication with the voices of those we have lost. Remember, they didn't have tape recordings. They didn't have photography. They might have a lock of hair, and they had a desperate desire to be in contact.
I'm glad that you talked about the technology they didn't have, because there was a significant amount of technological development in this period. You did start to have the telegraph.
The telegraph itself seemed like magic. The raps that the Fox sisters heard seemed very similar to the taps of Morse code, and it was a similar process using the alphabet to tap out a message.
So the telegraph may have contributed to the idea that there was no distance too far. How did spiritualists take up the idea of other technologies, particularly electricity?
Well, spiritualists very much thought of themselves as experimental scientists seeking empirical evidence of the immortality of the soul. They viewed men as representing the positive node of electricity and women the negative. These were connected in the seance circle. They believed they were creating an electrical circuit. Seances were practiced all over the country in people's homes, and there might be particular individuals in a community who became known as mediums and invited for seances, or it might just be a family member.
Some men were mediums, but mostly they were women. Why?
The perfect medium was a 14-year-old girl. She provided the fewest impediments to communication. She was old enough to have a good command of language and a presence, but she was assumed to be less educated and less able to dissemble than a male medium.
The spirits had fewer barriers to break through because these women offered so little resistance.
That's exactly right. They were presumed to be incapable of constructing the kind of political and scientific disquisitions that they often gave while under the influence of spirits.
And though society at the time would have penalized women, young or otherwise, who did show those aptitudes, women were safe if they were hiding behind a spirit voice. You have an opportunity to say something, to make a contribution, if you don't own it. Who wouldn't choose to go that route?
Women were taught to believe that they themselves were incapable of public speech. At the first Women's Rights Convention, there were people who attempted to speak in public who couldn't do it. And Susan B. Anthony was rather distressed about this. She didn't think women should be allowed to get up and speak if they couldn't make themselves heard. And it was the empowerment of the spirits that allowed many women to find a voice, to be able to make themselves heard. Now, does that mean that they were committing fraud because they believed that the power to do that came from spirits? I don't think so.
I'm just saying that these were remarkably receptive people, the kind of people who maybe in a different circumstance wouldn't need the cover of a spirit. And even if they believed it, do you?
I absolutely believe that the women whose own understanding of themselves was that they could not speak in public without the help of spirits. I believe that they were genuine in that understanding.
I think we can agree that by bringing women into the public square, it changed whose voices could be heard.
Whether that woman was a temperance advocate, a revivalist, or a spirit medium, she was likely to be the first woman that small community had ever heard speak in public. That experience itself was a revelation.
Many women who were active in the suffrage movement actually got their start as mediums.
The radical reformers were very attracted to spiritualism because it coincided with their understanding of individual sovereignty. If individuals could communicate with angels, could hear from the dead who might be sitting at the right hand of God, then you don't need a priest, you don't need ordination, you don't need theology. No individual should have absolute authority over another, whether they assert that authority as a slave master or as a husband who owns his wife. That notion of individual sovereignty raised questions about all kinds of hierarchy.
Now, listeners may wonder why we've spent so much time on spiritualism after having just had a walk through the Guggenheim exhibit of Hilma Afklin.
Hilma is really a remarkable example of someone whose life was profoundly changed by spirit communication. And I think she's also a wonderful demonstration of the ridiculousness of thinking that spirit mediumship is fraud. One of the most interesting quotes that I read from her is when she says, "It was not the case that I was to blindly obey the high lords of the mysteries, but that I was to imagine that they were always standing by my side." Now, to me, that sounds like many artists trying to convey a deeper truth. She understood that artistic expression as being directly connected to specific external intelligences. That's a little bit more concrete than I think what Hans Hofmann meant when he talked about the spiritual in art. but I think it's the same experience.
Have you ever wondered why she specified that her work be kept secret for at least 20 years after her death?
Oh, I wonder so many things. I want to know everything about her. I want to know how her group of five women artists, the five, was convened. Spiritualists thought you needed men and women to have the appropriate electrical circuit for a seance. How did they convene this group of five women artists? I've never heard of anything like that. The idea of her purifying herself for a year. Does that come from her exposure to Eastern religions through theosophy? Does it come from the Lutheran church? Or how she did it? Who was doing the cooking? I just can't conceive of this. I have 1,000 questions.
Anne, thank you so much.
Anytime.
Anne Browdy is the director of the Women's Studies in Religion program at Harvard Divinity School, and she's the author of Radical Spirits, Spiritualism and Women's Rights in 19th Century America.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Feder, John Hanrahan, and Asta Chaturvedi. And this week, we say goodbye to our intern, Samantha Maldonado. Sam, thank you. You were fantastic. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.